Hello, this is Layla Benitez-James, a new guest editor for the Asymptote podcast. Over the past year, I have heard so many amazing episodes here that I had to try making one of my very own. I have long been obsessed with the impossible puzzle that is translation, and lately have become particularly interested in those cases which seem to me most impossible of all. What some might call experimental works, or source text that is operating in two or more languages already. Literature that resists categorization from its very inception. If you want to see a great example of what I'm talking about, take a look at the multilingual writing in the current July issue of Asymptote, where you can also listen to the authors read their work. There, Omar Berada, Clara Duplessis, Karina Licorice Quinn, Kanya Kanchana, Greg Neeson, Noel Quiñones, and Sherban Fuarza unfurl poems and a story which stretch out across the traditional boundaries of working in one language and overflow into many others. They play, mixing English with Spanish and German, with French and Arabic, with Romanian, Sanskrit, and Afrikaans. So last September, I was in Brooklyn visiting friends, being a bridesmaid, and lucky enough to overlap with the beginning of the Brooklyn Book Festival. I've long been a fan of Kaveh Khanum, and some of my favorite poets happen to be reading during the week. After finding my way to J Street and the right elevator, I grabbed some cheese and grapes and settled in to listen to Rachel Eliza Griffiths and Latasha N. Nevada Diggs. Now the reading was really amazing, and Diggs's 2013 collection of poetry, Twerk, had reopened my eyes to the possibility of weaving together different languages and voices to great effect. In a review of Twerk for the online literary site Montevideo, poet Joel McSweeney wrote, "Language is not a neutral tool, and the history of the peoples who belong to these languages and the hegemonic forces that would distress, suppress, or obliterate both the languages and their peoples is what makes these poems so fierce." She's right. And I'm usually a bit shy. I really prefer to ghost after readings, but I really needed to ask Diggs something about Twerk. When I first read the book, and when she was reading her other poems, I couldn't help but try to imagine how I might translate these poems into Spanish, or any other language for that matter. Would I only carry the English across to my target language, leaving the other languages as they were? And what if there was Spanish in the original? Am I then translating Spanish to Spanish, or carrying over a kind of slanging Spanish which I hope stands out and calls to its origins in countries other than Spain, and to the neighborhoods of New York? I figured that in taking on these arguably more complex source texts, it might be helpful to then go to the true source to see what impulses created the works themselves. Happily, I got the chance to have a few conversations with some of the writers and a translator for our July issue to see if they could explain to me where this instinct to blend tongues comes from.
I get a lot of Claras here. Clara is a bit more, you know, the A goes down rather than Clara, which goes up.
Small vowel sounds, yeah, can make a big difference. This is Clara Duplessis, talking to me from Montreal.
I have dual citizenship in Canada and South Africa. I was born in Montreal, where I'm also living right now, but two South African parents, they were studying here at the time, and so when I was four and a half, five, we moved back to South Africa, which is where I grew up. And that time, which is like the first, you know, 18 years of my life, I spoke primarily Afrikaans. And for the last decade, I've been living in Montreal again, speaking primarily English. Both places that I'm from are very multilingual. Quebec is both French, it's the French province in Canada, but it's French and English. And then South Africa has 11 official languages. So there's always been the potential of multiple languages floating around. I write primarily in English, I would say, but all those languages are active in my mind, and when I'm thinking, those languages are active in my mind, and like there are wordplays that happen. Hey, this Afrikaans word actually sounds pretty cool. It's like a cool wordplay, and just letting it happen and then slipping back into English, slipping into German, slipping into French.
That's making me want to like jump to a question I had at the end, which was like this idea of allowing yourself to write in two languages and specifically your phrase of like an honest acceptance, because I feel like there is often that pressure. Or for example, a lot of times in poetry, you wouldn't talk about choosing a sonnet over free verse or something like that as something that you would need an right. honest acceptance for. But somehow writing in a multilingual space, we need to like come to terms with it in this weird way because there's a resistance.
Yeah, with a lot of writers. A strange kind of a judgment about mixing languages, which I find really bizarre, actually. You have to really want to do it. And I think it's pretty recently that I started realizing that a lot of people are also doing it, and some of my favorite writers these days. I heard there's a woman in Montreal, Oana Avasilicoi, who writes in, you know, English, French, Romanian at least. And I remember going to a reading and hearing her read and understanding the English and understanding the French but not understanding the Romanian at all. And realizing that that poem was still completely intelligible to me on an emotional way and in a sonic way. That thinking that you should be writing in one language because you can't communicate otherwise is a total false conception.
Do you have this consideration within the multilingual frame to like explain a little bit? There's an element of play in that first poem where it's like slaughtering and stutter ringing and seas and right. seen and seen. And so in one ways, it's like that kind of explains for the reader, like gives them another chance to understand it. But at the other, you know, at the same time, it's playful.
Yeah, there are two things happening. I mean, a couple of the examples, I would pretty much translate it immediately myself. So even if you weren't hovering above the Afrikaans words, I would have inserted it into the poem somehow else otherwise, so that you wouldn't, even if you didn't know what Afrikaans words meant, the meaning would come out through the English parts.
Right.
Then there are like the longer bits. There are a couple of pieces in that poem, Ekke, which, yeah, they're like four or five lines of solid Afrikaans. And for me, they have a lot of like sonic relevance to the rest of the poem. But for someone who doesn't speak the language, they wouldn't know how to pronounce it and they wouldn't know what it means. I honestly just think that's a risk. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you think about the reading process in general, it's not like anyone understands any piece 100%. You know, even if you speak the language, there's always going to be aspects of that text which are hidden. Even just for the reason that like geographies are so fluid these days, you could, you know, grow up in Asia and end up living in Canada, or, you know, live in 10 different places and pick up languages everywhere, and then somehow all of those languages infiltrate your subconscious, and then you start writing and like pick up, you know, start wanting to write all of those. This writing, I was like, oh, this is what I need to do. It's coming so naturally to me. It's my thing. And then of course you realize that there was like 100 other people. Somehow our age needs that.
Now from Montreal, we go to the southwest of France, where Omar Barada shares a similar story of movement leading to new languages.
I grew up in Morocco, in Casablanca specifically, and at the end of high school I moved to Paris to go to university and stayed on, lived there. And more recently, a couple of years ago, my family and I moved to New York. It's been a journey north and west. It's kind of a fascinating experience actually to ride the New York subway and see. There are a lot of signs, and usually when they put up signs to explain that, they oftentimes you find a sign in English and another one in Spanish and Polish or any kind of language. I mean, from the experience of living in Paris, that seems very odd because you wouldn't even imagine any kind of public transportation company putting up signs in a language other than French or maybe English if you really have to.
Right, maybe two languages, but not a handful.
No, and certainly not, you know, the language of a community. community that's living in an area, they wouldn't put up a sign in Polish or Arabic or Romanian or whatever, because everybody's supposed to submit to French.
Old Street. But what language are you mostly reading in? Or are you seeking out to read more in Arabic, it sounds like? Or are you mixing in more French? What is your like reading life like versus your writing life?
Well, my reading life depends on what I'm researching and what's available. It tends to be in French, English, and Arabic. If I have to choose, I choose French. I grew up with French and Arabic, but then, you know, from age 16 when I moved to France, French definitely was much more present. So a lot of my becoming an adult and becoming a reader and a writer has happened in French. I mean, I definitely experience the fact that language is not a transparent vehicle. Ideas. It is definitely ideas have different shapes and are probably different ideas when you try to write them in a language or in another. Wrap me up in your
best. Growing up in a language, you might consciously choose to work in another if you've learned it to kind of escape certain narratives, possibly.
Yeah, maybe that was a useful kind of impulse. Mm-hmm. It certainly when I moved to Europe from Morocco, for a number of years my impulse was to go explore.
Yeah.
You know, different European countries, different regions of France. And nail me to the floor. As much as the visas and the visa applications and the consulates would allow, I was more interested in learning new languages. I learned Spanish, I learned Italian, but I was more interested in sort of pursuing that line of flight of going more towards Europe than in, you know, keeping up with what was going on in Morocco or trying to travel back or a mute and blow. As a result, I mean, it was almost, I don't know, maybe it was some kind of an Oedipal impulse, but I kind of abandoned my origin. And somehow I realized at a certain point that the Arabic language is starting to feel a little foreign. You know, I think it has to do with this biographical fact of traveling and going towards something else. It also has to do with the structure of the Arabic language it's what linguists call its diglossic nature. Since the Arabic you speak at home is not the same as the one you learn in school.
Oh, right, yeah, that's very true.
You read. There are two kinds of levels of the language. So there's the standard Arabic, which is common to all 22 Arab countries. And so somebody in Morocco who can read can easily read a book that's written and published in Yemen or in Iraq or in Egypt. But the spoken languages are different. So it's hard to say, for anyone to say fully, that Arabic is their mother tongue, in the sense of the language they speak with their mothers at home.
Yeah, and so, and with your own poetry and with your own creative writing, do you think that you're mixing more in this more standard universal Arabic or more the home
Arabic? Is it, well, it kind of depends, but in the poem that was published in Asymptote of Pax Babadiana, there is a phrase in there in Moroccan Arabic, but the idea is to try and maybe clarify for myself or revive in certain ways my relation with classical Arabic poetry.
Yeah.
A certain type of language, a certain type of reference that holds the memory of the language itself. You know, for me, as I saw over time, Arabic as a language receding in my mind and in my practice. Of course, there are still things that I memorized in school or read when I was young that were still there somehow. Emotional chunks of language, in a way. You know, something that that's related to memory. There are these I don't know how to call them.
Yeah, no, I just, yeah, an emotional chunk of language just seems like a really appropriate way to describe something like that. Then, on the East Coast, Chris Tanasescu, also known as Margento in his translation work, unpacks the nuances of the multilingual translation task, and begins by explaining the relationship between French and Romanian, which Șerban Foarte's source text plays with.
I think naturally for a contemporary poet in a globalized world, right, to be multimedia and multilingual, historically speaking, our culture was quite significantly influenced by French culture starting in the 1700s and all the way through to like the to mid 20th century. Our literature, we're talking about a period in which the aristocracy, the intellectuals, the writers, they were fluent in French, and some of them writing mainly in French. So we have a special relationship with French, or we used to have, rather, a very special relationship to the French language and culture. And Foarte is one of the old school guys who's still very fashionable, as you know, as I already told you, he's a famous rock lyricist and so on and so forth,
right.
And the experimental kind of cutting edge poet, but also as an old school and a great erudite who can, you know, juggle so amazingly the two languages and other languages and go back and forth between them and thus develop a fantastic work of poetic improvisations and multiple meanings and layers of significance.
Yeah, that's great. So on the one hand, there is a kind of just reflection of reality, of like historical, political reality, and then on the other hand,
yeah,
you're kind of intentionally bringing in different languages for different registers as well.
Yes, yes, exactly. Foarte is also one of the mechanisms of his unique humor. All the puns that he makes and the plays on words and all the cross-cultural references and the way he shifts like instantly from one historical period to another, all of these things are performed very easily within the medium, sometimes confusion, if not total overlapping of French and Romanian.
What do you see as his particular way of, you know, quote-unquote, playing with language, or do you need to understand where that comes from as a translator?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's, you know, who isn't playful in good poetry? I mean, Shakespeare was very playful, right? And, I don't know, the classics, you know, between air quotes and all that. So, and maybe the more playful we are, the more serious we can get. It's a great opportunity for Șerban Foarte to reach various levels of significance and to like stick in all sort of very brief but quite edgy political references and allusions. And on the other hand, I think that comes in handy for a poet that focuses a lot on sound. So the vehicle of poetic performance, that is writing and translation. So the vehicle, the best vehicle for that is sound as interacting with meaning, that is like swimming against the tide of meaning or deconstructing and reshaping meaning. The multilingualism of Șerban Foarte is actually the language of his poetry. So it's not a way of adding up for placing languages on top of the other to just make things complicated, but paradoxically maybe it's quite the opposite. By switching from several languages in just a few lines, it actually simplifies by speculating on sound and puns and totally unexpected connections. He simplifies the procedure of the poem, and by that he amplifies the effect of the poem. And I would say that in that respect, poetry is fundamentally multilingual and multimedia.
I really, really like that, because I have heard the inverse as well from some people who will, you know, read a text and you're laughing. Like, they'll read a text, and I've heard this specifically about, for example, Gloria Anzaldúa's work, Borderlands. They'll say, oh, like, I don't have access to this part of the text, and so that makes it more confusing.
Well, that's part of the fun.
Yes, yeah.
Part of the responsibility that lies both with the author and the reader, where we collaborate in creating the poem. The poem is not a definite work of art, you know, in a museum that is given to us on a display, and that's it. We collaborate with the author, and we are co-authors, right? And we maybe sometimes, once in a while, we have to do our own research as readers, and the more maybe we look into the things that at first hand we don't understand, the greater the pleasure that will result from trying to decipher, to decode and recode.
Yeah, I mean, why wouldn't you want a poem to teach you something? Or why wouldn't you want a text to kind of teach you something new, to learn something new?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Just as the poet himself, I think, learns while learning, you know. Writing a good poem is also a very good opportunity, and the poem itself is a fantastic tool for research, for finding new things, and discovering and uncovering and recovering lost or totally new things. On the other hand, on a more technical level of writing such things or translating, which, like I said, for me is pretty much the same thing, such multilingual writing, it's interesting to note that the main language, so the language of power, again, between many scare quotes, in the poem is actually the victim of translation.
Right, because whatever language is not the quote-unquote main language, you leave alone.
Will survive, or will be like rendered. I had to in this particular case, I had to reinvent French-sounding words, Romanian words, or the French words per se, reinvent them so that they will sound a bit more palatable to the English reader. So in a way, anglicize them, but also give the French flavor. Whereas for Romanian words themselves, I simply translate them, because they are the invisible medium in multilingualism of the poem, and it is literally active, and the medium is the message, right?
Right.
As the classic said it. So the medium will have to remain invisible to perform its work, and that's how the main language, so the language of power, of the power within the poem, that was in this case Romania, is totally foreignized.
Into English.
Deterritorialized.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that, as a translator, that's where I start getting on uneven footing. Because you have to think of, okay, there is one language of power, and we're taking it into another language of power. And then there are these secondary or tertiary languages that are also getting moved over.
We have two kinds of power here, actually. We have the power within the poem, that is like the power of the poet working that poem, working on that poem, which is in this case the Romanian language. And I think it's a bit funny for us to be in a context in which we call the Romanian language a language of power, right? But that's a reality of the text.
Right.
And then it's the other kind of power, the power of the English language, which is the target language, and it comes with all its connotations of being a cosmopolitan language, and if not an imperialistic language. And it's a dominance, a hegemony of this language that we both reinforce by translating into English, and also subvert and deny to the extent of our powers by injecting it with the fake English words that we have to invent to render the flavor and hopefully the multilayered significance of the multilingual originals. Again, original between many scare quotes.
Right. And then there's also this concept of what would be foreign to the source language needs to be also foreign to the target language.
Exactly, yeah. So that's where the craft, if any craft is involved on the part of the translator, takes over, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
I guess just that you're making that decision.
Yeah.
Yeah, that you're making that decision of, like,
I, as a translator, I'm going to, you know, decide what needs to be foreign and how foreign it needs to be, how much I need to tweak it to be not so foreign as to be unrecognizable, but to still have a certain flavor of other.
Exactly, because you're moving like along a continuum, you know, of foreign, still comprehensible, totally incomprehensible, you know, too understandable or too comprehensible, which would render it like bland. Yeah, so you have to like negotiate all the parameters and all the variables in a way that will stir interest and still keep it, like I said, comprehensible, at least to a certain extent.
Yeah, I guess you have to kind of narrow in your view of your target audience as well. You have to kind of narrow in and say, like, all right, there's a general, quote-unquote, understanding that they're going to have, even though some people will be familiar with more, some people will be familiar with less. You have to kind of imagine this middle ground.
Right, exactly, yeah. And you negotiate that territory by actually denying it. Denying that another very interesting piece in this issue lingers on the differences between territory and place, and how place is negotiable and free and shared, and territory is controlled. And I think that multilingual language does that, you know, it brings place where power would bring territory. So in negotiating with the readership and negotiating actually the notion of potential readership, I think that the translator of multilingual piece of writing is actually trying to keep a good balance between territory and deterritorialization and place and rebellious nomadism.
See, when we translate, we are not just translating one language to another, but moving cultures around. Translating a novel with a target audience in the UK is really different from having North American readers in mind. Courgettes must become zucchinis. Lifts will become elevators, etc. With Diggs's work, I would really pray that the publisher would allow the original to lay alongside its translation so you can see that original hybrid form is not lost. Tired of wondering alone, I went up and asked her if her work was translated and into which languages. I had led by saying how much her work meant to me, and I think this is where normal people tend to leave off after a reading. But what followed was really fascinating. She told me about her work being translated into German, and about how there were very specific choices made as to what got translated and how. You see, Germany has its own slang and its own way of bending language beyond what you might learn in your standard beginner's German class, a fact Greg Neeson explores in his poetry and explains beautifully in his author's note.
I grew up monolingual, speaking English, and I was just really kind of attracted to the German language. I think I've always been interested in kind of that tension between speech and writing, how slang kind of always outpaces writing. The thing about this Kiezdeutsch poem is basically, it's not just something that to English speakers is unseen, but it's something that you hear, like in a city like Berlin, you hear this everywhere. It's not particularly foreign or unique. You hear it everywhere, but you don't really see it in writing at all. Kiezdeutsch is actually the way the changes, the sort of slang things that happen in Kiezdeutsch are things that happen to languages in general over long periods of time. But why it was so kind of, I guess why this whole debate sprung up is that it was happening really fast. It was like the sort of rate of change and sped up related to sort of the multilingual environments that it was being spoken in. There was a debate in the German press in 2012 that was sort of centered on, you mentioned this to me also, the language purity, and it was like this ideological discussion of language change that actually didn't pay attention to how any of this happened.
Right. Yeah, and we have those conversations in English as well. Some people have this sort of idea of keeping English pure when it, you know, of course it never has been quote-unquote pure.
Of course, yeah, and that sort of standard American English is a fiction. Like, no one speaks standard American English.
Right.
I've had a number of people ask me, like, why didn't you do this in America? Like, wouldn't you be able to understand so much better? And German, and sort of listening to the German, it's... Kiezdeutsch wasn't marked for me as, like, a specifically errant language. It was also just, like, a German that I was trying to understand, so
Oh, yes. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. They were it was equally as foreign to you as German, and so they were almost equal in your mind, whereas to a native German speaker, there's just this automatic difference.
Exactly. These differences get mapped onto, like, sound, like, literally phonemes, like the difference between ish and ish, which is basically just like that CH sound in the middle of the mouth or the front of the mouth. People will like extrapolate that into a whole dialogue about migration and language purity. And I find that really interesting how tiny little shifts in sounds kind of get played into these nationwide cultural debates. As I was writing this, and I was kind of just trying to engage a sort of multilingual space, because I think that was sort of the context that Kiesewich emerges from, is being spoken in a lot of multilingual areas, even though it is just German with loan words the way any other language has loan words. But so pulling from sort of comment sections and article and documents, it wasn't like to efface myself in the documents, but I wanted to engage that actual debate and not sort of purely distort Kiesewich towards my own sort of like creative means. I wanted to see if it was possible to translate the situation, the context in which it emerges and in which it's discussed, and in that way kind of refrain from translating Kiesewich a lot, or introduce it first in German and then give the translation in English later.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So the kind of power structures or the political history is kind of right there front and center, rather than being hidden, or rather than being a footnote.
Exactly, yeah. And Germany's migration history, for example, with Turkish migrants, like the Berlin specifically has the largest Turkish population outside of Turkey. So that was something like I wanted to allude to in the author's note, because even though it's not, this is, you know, there are also people who their parents speak Polish and they speak Kiesewich or Arabic or many other languages. Yeah, that's a sort of very specific migration history that also really shaped the city in various ways, and you sort of feel that culture and also the way that sort of relates to, I mean, even given this sort of huge influx of refugees, like Angela Merkel was like, multiculturalism doesn't exist. That's not a thing. That's not what we're shooting for. It doesn't work. The language gets used to various purposes. It doesn't kind of hold that ideology in itself. It's kind of, and that's what's part of using the documents, was to show the ways in which it was sort of angled to various political purposes. But I wanted to do the sort of multilingual punning and wordplay to kind of ground the experience of the poem in tracing the language itself, that wordplay across a boundary that you usually don't think of between German and English, as opposed to just in one of those.
That element of play as well, like that's something that I keep hearing from different writers who work in a multilingual space, is like wordplay, this idea of having fun with language and showing where it's kind of leaping across the gaps already.
When I first read the poetry of Uliana Wolf when I was in college and I just started studying German, I read her book Falsche Freunde, False Friends, where she writes sort of these prose poems surrounding false cognates in German and English, and it seems to swim in and out of both languages, and there's many words such as art, which is, you know, art in English, it means way in German, or bad, which is bath in German, bad in English, or the most famous example, much talked about, is gift, which is poison or present. Then Susan Bernowski did a translation into English, and obviously the context is different for most German readers of might, you know, have English, but a lot of English readers, most do not have German. So Susan Bernowski translated, basically tried to do the same jumping across borders of words, but just in English.
Well, that's all for this conversation at the moment. If you would like to read more multilingual writing or check out more from the latest issue of Asymptote, you can find it all online, as well as information about our January 2017 issue, which will be an Indian language literature feature. We are still seeking previously unpublished English translations of Indian language work by contemporary writers, and the deadline for submissions is coming up on November 1st. If you are an educator and want to teach pieces from new issues of Asymptote, check out our new Educator's Guide, where you can already download guides from the spring and summer issues of Asymptote. Happy reading.